Hey there, everybody. It is Thursday, December 6th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by sending an email on over to Ken at thisshowisogay.com. We love hearing from you. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our dog and pony little gay radio show. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a fun show we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Dr. Frankie Bichon is the CEO and founder of Little Gay Book, specializing in lesbian matchmaking and bisexual matchmaking for singles in the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, New York, and Hawaii. She holds a doctorate in the field of psychology and is an expert in the field of human behavior and matching with years of experience. She is a fellow New Jersey native. She's just one of my most favorite guests. Dr. Frankie Bichon, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken. Thanks so much for having me back. I'm excited to be here.
So I did call my mom to confirm that you and I are not indeed separated at birth.
Well, that's good.
I just wanted to, we have the New Jersey thing. We're the same age. We both love dachshunds.
Yes.
You are a dachshund lover.
Myself.
I had a miniature dachshund, so, you know, but my mom said no, that was not a correct theory.
Is your dachshund's name Lucy?
Odessa.
Odessa. Okay.
So, but I, you
just
know,
making
I,
sure.
I, are you a Pisces as well?
I am not. I'm a Sag.
All right. So it's not, we're not twins, but we sure do have a lot in common and much to talk about for this week's episode. Are you ready?
Yes. Let's hear it.
Well, let's start out with matchmaking. Let's talk about matchmaking. What makes Dr. Frankie Bichon for a successful matchmaker? There sure are a lot out there, but I don't know that they're all so effective.
The first word that comes to mind is fearlessness.
Nice.
So I kind of have to be out there all everywhere. I kind of have to make appearances everywhere and network within the community, trying to reach all the different circles and networks of people in the community. So I'm pounding the pavement a lot, and I'm networking a lot. And I love what I do, and I love to connect with people. So I gain energy from being around people. So I think a big part of it is just being sort of confident and comfortable getting out there and walking up to people randomly even. Like, I could be shopping and I could notice somebody who might be a potential for one of my clients, a potential match. I'll just walk right up and introduce myself.
Please tell me you call them potentials.
Yes, catches.
That's fantastic.
Potential catches, potential matches. So a catch is somebody who's in my database, interested in meeting one or more of my clients.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I am fascinated.
Is that bad?
This is great. No, I love it. I love it. Now, you have a whole team of people that work there at Little Gay Book, do you not?
I do. And they do different things. I mean, some people do matchmaking work for me. Some people are just on the ground networking, spreading the word about Little Gay Book, because we don't really advertise. We do minimal advertising. It's more about meeting people face-to-face and sharing about our process of matchmaking, and because people don't have a frame of reference a lot of times.
Right.
They think right away, oh, matchmaking. Okay, so that must be like Match.com. You have another website out there that's doing, you know, something like Match.com, which is so, so different. So we help people to really understand what that is.
One of the things that I love about your website is there's an FAQ section, and one of the questions that you put out there is, what is your success rate? And you redefine that question to be, you know, it's not necessarily about success because people are looking for different things. It's whether or not people want to stay working with you, which they clearly do. What do you think it is about you that people want to keep working with?
The process. They learn so much about themselves, and I'm so involved in the process from start to the, you know, start to finish. So there are people that work with me that, you know, go out on quality dates, they fuel their self-esteem, they feel really, really, really good about themselves, and I'm giving them coaching throughout. Some people sign up for formal coaching, but regardless, through the matchmaking process, I'm giving them feedback that I'm getting from the women I'm introducing them to, but I'm also them giving them feedback in terms of what I'm seeing. And I want them to be successful. I want them to find somebody great. And on their own, aside from the work that we're doing together, they're out there, you know, putting themselves out there, going
right
to events. They're networking themselves and trying to meet people. Because when you're feeling good and confident about yourself, coming off of some good dates, quality dates, and they may not have been matches, but nonetheless, they're good. You know, you had a good time. You know, when you're sitting across the table from somebody and you're just like, wow, this is like really great conversation. I feel really good about this person. I may not feel chemistry between us, but this is a great date. It's not like a bad date you know, that you hear all, I'm sure you've heard lots of stories, right?
Yes, I've told lots of stories. Oh, yeah.
Yes. So that's it. So it's like people don't have that experience when they're working with us. They have, you know, they go out, we hope that there's chemistry, but there's definitely compatibility because we're not sending people out to meet one another that don't demonstrate some level of compatibility.
Right. Now, don't name any names because that would not be ethical, but are there sometimes some catches or potentials that come in and you say, oh, you know what, you need a little bit more help than I can provide?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that's the case. And sometimes we have to say, you know what, at this point in time, we can't take you on as a client. We don't take everybody on as a client. And sometimes I will suggest that they meet with me for a certain number of sessions. I usually recommend initially 6 sessions of coaching. And then we revisit the idea of them coming on as a matchmaking client. But we definitely don't take everybody on. We want to be successful in matching people, and sometimes there are people that kind of need some work.
Yeah, and then you give them advice. So you give them advice, and you say, look, this is what I need you to do out on this date, eye contact, whatever it is, you know, that you lay out, and they come back, and they don't do any of those things. How frustrated do you get?
Yeah, I get frustrated. My frustration is channeled in a constructive way.
Of course,
right?
It is.
So I'm not demeaning, I'm not insulting, but I'm very direct.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll, you know, they'll sense my irritation, but it's really coming from just because I work so hard to find quality introductions.
Right.
That if they screw it up, it's like, oh, you know what I mean? This is somebody who I thought would be great for you. And what? And you, all you did was talk about yourself the entire time.
Right.
And ask one question. It's a little frustrating, right? So, you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt, but if it keeps happening, then, you know, Frankie gets a little bit more frustrated.
Ken, I told you not to propose right out the gate. I told you that, and I did it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I did have a client. I won't say any names, but I did have a client that went on a fabulous date. Sure enough, right after the 3-hour date,
oh, no.
They went back to her house, and they bought tickets to New York City and went on, like, a rendezvous for, you know, 3 days. In New York. And that was the end of the, you know, they went, they had a fabulous time, they dated for a few weeks, and they crashed and burned.
Yeah. Too much. Too much too soon.
It's too much too soon, you know? So that's a no-no. And, you know, I'm pretty clear about that. And I think people really want, they trust my guidance, and they trust me as an expert, and I think that they want to be successful. So for the most part, they cooperate, you know?
Yeah. But you try to push people a little bit outside of their comfort zone, though, right?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. Because, you know, we tend to repeat patterns, and those patterns aren't necessarily good patterns for us, you know, and that's why people oftentimes are coming to Little Gay Book for guidance, because
right.
They keep, for example, they're, you know, continually attracted to a narcissistic kind of personality, somebody who's really self-absorbed, or somebody who's a real introvert, and they're, you know, wanting to sort of, they're introverted themselves, for example, and they want to meet somebody who's a little more extroverted that's going to help pull them out of their shell.
Yeah.
But they tend to be attracted to women who are similar to themselves. So I see that. So people come to me wanting to change these patterns. So I absolutely have them step out of their comfort zone.
Nice.
And it doesn't feel good. You know, initially
No.
It feels real, right? It feels really uncomfortable. So, you know, I acknowledge that, and I sort of prepare them.
Yeah.
That this is not going to, it's like going to therapy, right? It's like, you know, you're bettering yourself, but it's not going to be easy.
Can't
if it
you just,
were easy, it wouldn't be improving yourself, you know? It
can't you just change easy. Everyone else, though? Wouldn't that be easier for me if you changed everyone else instead of me?
Oh, sure. Yeah. That would be
too great.
Too bad life doesn't work that way, right?
well, let's talk about the women. You've obviously, I'm making an assumption, but I'm feeling confident that you have met straight women before in your life.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is it about working with lesbians that is different for you than working with straight women?
You know, I mean, it's hard for me to answer that question just because I haven't really worked with straight women doing matchmaking so much. So since I started Little Gay Book, I've been working primarily with lesbians. Initially, I worked with gay men as well. But, you know, I feel like working with lesbians, it's, I would say they're, you know, I'm going to make maybe a gross generalization.
Go
but
for
oftentimes,
it.
Straight women are looking for husbands to have a family with. Is that a horrible gross generalization?
No.
Okay.
No. They're not listening anyway, so keep going.
Okay, good. So I don't want to sound like a total jerk, but that's my sense. And lesbians aren't necessarily, they're not really necessarily looking for that, right? They want companionship. They want, some of them want to have a family, but it's less common. Mostly they just want to have somebody to sort of do fun things with, to, you know, share their lives with. So,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to answer because I haven't really worked that closely with straight women trying to match them. I have had the thought that I would love to work with heterosexuals more recently. Yeah.
Have you worked with gay men in matching them?
I have.
What's the difference between, she just chuckled. No, not really.
An honest answer.
Yes, I would like to know, but know that I have an edit button and I'm not scared to use it.
Okay, well, you can put me in my place, please. Feel free. You know what? It was really hard, and that's kind of why I was like, I'm connected to the lesbian community. Why don't I just make my life a little easier and put men on the side for, you know, however long until I'm ready to revisit it. What happened with working with gay men is that oftentimes when there was chemistry, they were already intimate before,
right,
like on the second date or on the first date. And I really like people to take it slow initially,
right,
especially if you find somebody that you have chemistry with and that you're getting on well with. Like, don't jump into the sack so quickly. And they weren't telling me, so they, behind my back, they would be having sex, and then I would confront them, and it was like, you know, I could tell.
Yeah.
So, that was frustrating for me.
Well, let's take it further. Tell us why. Tell us why we should not be having sex on the first or second date, especially if our goal is, you know, this long-term thing that we're going for.
Okay, so it's really about biology, actually. So there's a chemical change, I should say, that occurs in the brain right away when you're attracted to somebody. There's oxytocin and serotonin that's secreted in the brain. Oxytocin makes you feel like you want to spend every waking moment with that person. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely.
Like, right. That date that turned into a weekend, you're still wearing the same clothes?
Yeah.
So there's that piece, the oxytocin, and then the serotonin makes you feel euphoric. You just, like, you're glowing, like, you just can't, there's nonstop permigrin. So we want to slow down the secretion of those chemicals in our brain, and if you, you know, jump into the sack, right, and you have an orgasm, game over.
Game over.
Oh, yeah. So now you're feeling amorous feelings for this person, right?
Right.
You're feeling all these intense emotions that are actually chemical. So you can't tell anymore. It blurs the lines. Like, you can't tell whether, hey, am I really feeling connected to this person because I actually enjoy their company? You know, I love kind of, I'm loving who they are right now. I'm really interested in getting to know them more. Or is this because I feel in love with them? You know what I mean? Like, I want to move in right now with them.
Right.
So,
which you shouldn't do on the first date, right? That's what I'm getting.
No.
Okay.
You should not do it on the first date.
I'm still learning.
I would, you know, I don't know what I've probably, it varies here and there probably, but I think that I would say 7 dates in, something like that, 6, 7, 8 dates in.
Okay.
You know, where you have a good amount of time to kind of get to know the person, get a sense of how they see themselves, how they see the world, how they see others.
But it's okay to move in with them on the second date. It's
oh,
just,
totally.
Yeah, just don't have sex.
Totally.
Yeah,
that's
there.
That's the right thing to do.
I'm there. Well, see,
the
look at what we're learning.
To say is that we all put our best selves forward.
Yeah.
If we want to be successful, we're sort of wanting to put our best selves forward on a first date. That's not our true self.
Look at that.
It might be, you know what I mean? It might be, for some of us, it might be close to our true self, but not entirely. So by the 7th date, you're kind of seeing more of the real person. They're getting more relaxed. They're less anxious, you know?
Right.
They're disclosing more information about themselves, their history, their past. So, you know, you want to just know more information before you decide to, you know,
go there.
The quick and dirty. Yeah.
Well, let me just say, as a case study, my ex-husband still talks about that he feels I misrepresented my love for Harry Potter on our first date, that I overemphasized it. So, you know, even years later, it can come up. We're not our true selves on our first date.
That's funny. Did you think that he would be, you know, into that? Was that something that was in his profile?
It was something he was very into, and he feels that I expressed too much that I loved it, and he did not see the evidence of that. So feel free to use that case study, you know, as you see fit.
I like that. That's a perfect example. It's a good
years
one.
Later. Years later.
Yeah.
All right, so one of your methods, I love that there's an events page. We're all about the events. Speed dating. The thought makes me want to vomit. I cannot even remotely wrap my head around speed dating. And I would imagine that there are some people who are like, are you kidding me? There's no way I'm doing that. I can't make an impression that quickly. Sell speed dating to me.
Yeah, so most people get very anxious. I mean, that is a very normal reaction.
I'm anxious right now talking about it.
So, you know, instead of thinking of it as speed dating, think of it as speed networking.
Okay.
Approach it a little bit differently.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I don't know about other people's speed dating events, but at my events, you can match on several different categories. You can match for friendship, business, or second date. Because the first speed date is considered your first date. So I like people to just kind of do a reframe and just think about it as meeting more people outside of your social circles. And really, I try to give them everything that they need. They don't need to do anything other than follow my directions. I give them the questions to ask each other. I tell them they know up front in the beginning that they have 3 minutes for each date.
Oy.
And I rotate them. So you really just need to sit down and kind of know how to have a conversation in a volley, right? You ask a question, she gives a response, and then you know, back and forth, back and forth. So, and you know, I mean, you know Malcolm Gladwell?
Of course. We love the blink.
The blink, right? What does it say there? In how many seconds do we actually decide whether there is chemistry or not, or, right? It's
pretty darn quick. Oh, yeah.
It's really quick. So I give you 3 minutes. So you get a chance to really get a sense of, like, oh, is there some chemistry here? And it's not too long where you're like, oh, my God, kill me right now.
Right.
I can't even sit for another second with this person. Somebody once told me, actually, not long ago, that she sat down for her speed date, and the woman looked at her and said, you know what, I can tell right now there's no connection here, so why don't we just take a breather? I've been talking so much already. Let's just take a break.
Break time. Now, I am more interested in the other extreme of, all right, so I have my 3 minutes, and you pair me up with this person, and I just raise my hand after the 3 minutes and start yelling, soulmate, soulmate, no, I don't want to move on to the next person. How would you respond in that moment?
I'd say, you know what, you need to be respectful to everybody in this, you know, speed dating experience, and you never know, you might make new friends. So that hasn't happened exactly, but things similar to that nature have happened. But I'd say, you know, there's no way that you know this person is your soulmate. It sounds like there's chemistry. And you know what? I think that you guys should indicate interest on your form, and I will make sure to email you each other's contact info. Let's keep going. And I wouldn't give it too much attention.
You are in so much control. I love it.
Oh, my. People laugh. They say, oh, my gosh, Dr. Frankie, I never knew you were so controlling.
I love it.
I'm really not, but it's so chaotic, and people get... When they're anxious, they get kind of crazy. And then you add alcohol on top of it, it's a little nutty.
And what should we wear?
You need to look cute.
Yeah.
You need to make an effort. Like, before you come to my speed dating event or any speed dating event, shower, pick out maybe a new shirt that makes you feel comfortable and, you know what I mean, like, attractive, and you feel good in it. Smell good.
Yeah.
Don't show up smelling.
Have you ever turned anyone away and said, you know what, you just can't wear that?
No.
Okay. Have you thought it really hard?
I have.
Okay.
I have. And body odor, that's one that's like definitely a very, it's just painful. And I have had to tell my clients that they have body odor, and it is so.
It's uncomfortable.
I can't tell if it's harder for me or for them.
Right.
To have that conversation. It's terrible.
Let's go with you. Let's just say it's harder for you.
I think so.
You're the
really
guest.
Do.
You're the guest. All right, well, we have to get to our listener questions. We had 3 listeners write in with their relationship questions. It's my favorite part. It's my favorite part. You ready?
Yeah.
All right, question number 1. Dr. Frankie, I have been with my spouse for 10 years, and this cracks me up, and it is just now starting to irk me that he is such a pessimist, whereas I am such an optimist. Help.
Jeez. Well, I wonder if the two of them can sort of meet in the middle, you know, like somebody who's a real pessimist, because it sounds like they're both on extreme ends.
Right.
So I wonder if they both can sort of meet in the middle and help each other, speaking of reframe, like help each other sort of reframe for a minute. I think of it as like taking off your glasses, your pessimistic glasses, and switching them for something that's more, you know, neutral, more in the middle.
All right. There we go. Let's meet in the middle. All right, question number two. This is from Susie in New York City. This is what she wrote. Dr. Frankie, I swear to you, you would think that there were words before this. There weren't. Dr. Frankie, I love her. I really love her. Everything about her, but the sex. Everything else is sheer perfection. We just don't have the same energy sexually. We're both a little on the submissive side. Though I can take charge, it'd be nice to once not have to. This seems so core to who she is, so I don't hold out hope of it changing, but I don't want to lose her either.
Yeah, so you know what? I would recommend, I don't know where, so she's in New York, so there's definitely something in New York. I think it's Toys in Babeland.
Oh, yeah.
Toys in Babeland, right? It's like Good Vibrations here in California.
It's.
I would contact them. I would find out when they have a workshop, and I would go with your partner to that workshop and learn how to be more assertive. They teach you all sorts of skills. So together, explore it, become more comfortable with your sexuality, and hopefully you'll be able to take it to, you know, the next level.
Now, all of the other pieces of relationship, everything is 100% great, but the sex is not great. How much of a... You can work on it.
You can work on it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean... You know, for some people, the sex is great, and not many things in the relationship are great. And I think if you were going to pick one or the other, depending, I guess, on how old you are. But I would pick, if that was me, if everything else in our lives was wonderful, we were amazing companions, we had a lot of similar interests, there was a lot of respect and love in our relationship, and the sex wasn't great, I would choose that over the alternative. So, because the sex you can work on. Like, challenge each other. Maybe suggest some, you know, bondage. I don't know a ton about it. I hear about it from my clients. They educate me.
Yeah.
You know, but try to step out of your comfort zone and just see. Maybe there's some of that stuff lying dormant, like that interest or that drive that we don't realize until we put ourselves out there and, like, play, you know, role play, learn about toys, sex toys, how you can incorporate them into your sex life. There's tons of books out there. I just would try to really explore other options to spice it up.
You can work on it.
You really can. You really can work on it. You just have to make the effort, you know? And again, it feels awkward because it's forcing you to do something that's not familiar and it's uncomfortable. But just push yourself through it, you know? And you'll grow.
Question number three, and this one comes from Ken, a radio host in southern Vermont, who I think sounds kind of cute. He writes in, I went on a date... By the way, this is me. I went on a date, and the guy was cute and interesting, but I feel like I learned more about his ex than I did about him. That's a red flag, right? Signed, Ken, the guy hosting this show, right now.
I love it. Yes, major red flag. It's a real problem when somebody's on a first date and they're struggling with boundaries right from the start. Like, do you really, you want to learn about his past relationships, but do you really want to learn that on your first date? No.
Frankie, we didn't even get to the table.
Oh.
I'm just saying.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I would imagine that's what the listener who wrote in with this question, that's what happened to him. I'm just saying.
Yeah. It's not obvious or anything.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate, and that's a red flag. You know, if it was really kind of minimal... and when he realized you weren't actually asking follow-up questions, which hopefully you didn't.
No.
Hopefully you stayed boundaried and you didn't follow up with anything, inquiring with more, you know, you leave it alone. And then hopefully he would sort of redirect and move on to something else. But if not, and he just went on and on, that would be probably it for me.
Was it inappropriate at the end of the date for me to ask for his ex's contact information? Because he sounded way more intriguing.
I would make a joke, actually. Maybe you could have said that.
Yeah, I kind of said
joke.
That. He did not think
seriously.
That was funny. I just want to put it out there that people watch your tone. because they might not think that's funny, especially if the bitterness factor is relatively high. So
yeah,
I'm here to help. I'm here to help folks.
I love it.
What about kids? So, you know, you want kids. When do you talk about kids? Should it come up on a first date?
You know, I think also, again, depending on your age, like I'll tell you, I'll do a little self-disclosure here. When I was 25 and I was out there, you know, dating and really thinking I wanted to have a family before I was 30, I was on a first date saying, hey, I just want to let you know, I want to put this out there. I really want a family. It's a deal breaker for me. So if you don't want kids, we can be friends. Like, you know, I was very upfront about it because I didn't want to waste time.
Right.
So I think it depends on where you are in life, you know, like if you're young, have fun. Don't worry about it, you know, but if you're getting to the point where you're kind of really visualizing the next 3 years, you want to be pregnant, you know, or you want to adopt or whatever it is, I think you should be upfront.
Yeah.
So you don't want to waste time.
Now, you mentioned age. Do you have any hard and fast rules about age differences?
10 years.
There you go. That's a hard and fast rule.
You know, past 10 years, there's just a generational, it's like the, you know, shared kind of pop culture, kind of thing. It's just music interest. Like, it starts to, I think there becomes a bigger gap over, I think it's over 10 or 12, because there's been research done. I think it's 12 years, actually. So I would say somewhere between 10 and 12 years.
Okay.
Beyond 12, then it can be an issue. But I've seen couples that are amazingly happy for many, many years that have a bigger gap than that. So
okay.
You can make it work. But generally speaking, I wouldn't go beyond 12.
All right. That is good to know. So now, other than asking for our date's ex's phone number, contact information, and showering, any other, you know, first date tips that would really help us out?
Think about your goal being you really want to get a sense of how this person kind of relates in the world, how they see the world. You want to know, you know, like this is just my speed dating. One of my speed dating questions is like, if you, you know, won or inherited $500 million, how would you spend it? You know, or if you were put into a time capsule, where would you want to end up? You want to just kind of, you want to hear about how they think and how they see themselves and how they see others. So think about the bigger picture and less about the details, like, you know, what they do on the job. And, you know, I mean, you can ask that, but spend more time trying to really get a sense of their inner workings and, you know, who they are.
Now, if you do not like their answer to the time capsule question, is it inappropriate to ask them, well, how do you think your ex would answer that? Because they sound interesting. I see now that's where I went awry.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah, no. Bad idea.
You're so controlling. You're so controlling. It's really you and your rules, your Dr. Frankie rules.
You know, it's like I have a lot of experience and practice. I got to just help people kind of cut to the chase, right? Like,
right.
Why reinvent the wheel? I've already done it.
Now,
I've seen people do it time and again. Yeah.
I'm very curious if you have different rules based on geography, because the Hawaii scene is very different than the New York scene, which is very different than the California scene. Is there anything different that you advise people, or these are really just constants no matter where you are?
Many of them are pretty constant, but like, you know, with the Hawaii scene, you know, we're much, the Hawaii speed dating is more like my consultant in Hawaii does a whole flirting piece in the beginning of the speed dating to help relax everybody. And I think there it's more of a very intimate sort of experience, whereas here it's like in San Francisco, it's fast moving, it's intense. The women can handle it, but my sense is that in Hawaii, it's much more kind of slower paced, intimate and personal. So it's different. They need different things there than we do here.
All right. So we all just need to be a little bit more intentional, figure out what our goals are. We should know what our goals are going in, right?
Yes.
All
be
right.
Clear. Yeah. And think about one thing you really need to think about is your deal breakers. Do not have too many of them. They stand in the way if you find, you know, being successful in finding somebody. You want to be really realistic and honest with yourself, because, you know, I think a big mistake that people make is they have unrealistic expectations and they sort of, you know, even today I had a client say to me, you know, Frankie, you need to find me Halle Berry. Like, I want somebody who looks like Halle Berry. And I'm thinking, oh my, but look, I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just be realistic, you know.
All right.
Yeah.
We love this.
And I love being on your show.
We adore having you on our show. Folks need to stroll on over to littlegaybook.com. You can get in touch with Frankie there. You can schedule life coaching sessions. You can just learn more about what you can do to discover more about yourself and about others. We love
and
having you on.
Fill out profiles, guys. Yeah, get on there and fill out a confidential profile. It takes 5 minutes, and then they put you in the database so that we can potentially introduce you to our clients.
My long-lost sister, we will have you back on the show.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. Thanks so much.
All the best.
Great holiday, everybody.
To you as well.
Guess I wasn't the best one to ask. Me, myself, with my face pressed up against love's glass. To see the shiny toy I've been hoping for, the one I never can afford. The wide world spins and spits turmoil, and the nations toil for peace. The paws of fear upon your chest, only love can soothe that fear. And my words are paper tigers, no match for the predator of pain inside her. I say, love, come to you, hoping just because I spoke the words if they're true, as if I've offered up a crystal ball of truth. And if there's now one, there will born under the sign of cancer. Like brushing cloth, I smooth the wrinkles for an answer. As I'm always closing my eyes and wishing I'm fine,
even though I know you're not.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we welcome back to the show our favorite lawyer, new media thinker, LGBT and diversity advocate, speaker, media commentator. I think you added some labels on there since we last did this. Jimmy Nguyen, welcome back to this show, Is So Gay.
Thank you. I'm back with new labels.
You have new labels, and I left a couple off because I think one of them was fitness buff. Do you want that said?
Definitely.
Okay.
I've been working out really hard recently.
Now
that I'm 40, I've decided to amp up the fitness regimen even more.
He doesn't look a day over 39, folks. He doesn't.
It's supposed to be 30 because I have the Asian 10-year discount.
And we will get into that. Now, first, yes. News for our listeners. Jimmy Nguyen is now tied with singer-songwriter Eric Hyman for most appearances on the past 4+ years of This Show Is So Gay. For those keeping score at home, are you okay with
That's
that?
That's awesome. I thought I was, like, in the lead.
No, you're not. No, because, Jimmy, I was doing the show for 3 years before you even came on.
All right, great. Me and Eric Hyman. Awesome.
You guys, that would be an interesting little duking it out there because he's pretty buff as well. Anyway, well, Jimmy, you have written a new piece for our friends at the Huffington Post. It is entitled, Why We Need More LGBT Racial Minority Role Models. We start where we always start. As you're sitting down and coming up with new ideas for pieces that you want to put out to the public, where's the genesis for this latest piece?
Well, the genesis for this piece came really inadvertently. I was, you know, checking my Jimmy Nguyen Facebook page,
yes,
my media brand, one day, and I got an email from a young gay closeted Vietnamese young man in Southern California who said that he started following me recently on Facebook after reading a list of most influential LGBT Asian icons that had been published on the Huffington Post Gay Voices. and asked from me for advice about how to come out to his old school Asian parents.
Okay.
My first reaction is how nice of it was that somebody, you know, reached out to me for advice.
And yeah.
The second reaction is, what is this influential LGBT Asian icons thing he's talking about? Because I didn't know anything about it. So I looked on the Huffington Post, and lo and behold, there was a listing by an intern there, because it was he was trying to take steps to reflect the diversity of the LGBT community in some of their coverage. He put together a list of 54 LGBT Asian people who were doing influential things, and I happened to be on the list.
Look at that.
Look at that.
Well, wait a second. Let's not say happened to be on the list. You were deliberately and intentionally placed on the list.
You know, that's true. It's just, it's, you know, when you look at the other people on the list, it's like George Takei and Margaret Cho and people who are just, you know, very well known. You know, we all, you know, it was a little humbling experience to be on the list. So it was both, I was very proud to be on the list, but also very humbled by it as well.
They have not been on my show, so you're number one in my book right now.
Oh, well, thank you. So the fact that this intern at Huffington Post created this list and published it led to this young man from Southern California emailing me, because he is who I was many years ago, young,
yeah,
gay, closeted Vietnamese, trying to figure out how to come out to his, you know, quote, old school Asian parents.
Right.
So I wrote him back a very long note giving some advice. He ended up putting it on his blog, which he operates, but not under his real name. He doesn't have his actual name on there. And then I also got another email from someone in Indonesia who had also seen the list and sought advice from me as well. And it just made me realize that these two people reached out to me through email cyberspace, in part because I was on this list, but I think in large part because I was a fellow gay Asian person.
Yeah.
And it made me realize that there aren't that many LGBT Asians or other people of color that are very visible in media and politics and business and law. And that's how I came up with the idea of writing this. I felt like this was a reminder of why it was important to have more LGBT role models of color. We need to get more people visible in the media, because all of us can have mentors and role models from any different background. Like,
right,
I have mentors who are African-American women or who are straight white men. You can have mentors from all different backgrounds, but there's something unique and important about seeing people who look like you succeeding above you to, I think, give you greater inspiration. And so that's why I decided to write this.
Now, do you go to the comments section of these articles?
Once in a while, I do.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I mean, it was really affirming.
I have looked at the ones on Huffington Post, yes. They are mostly affirming.
Yes.
Except there's one that was less affirming, but that's okay. I'm totally open to criticism. You don't put stuff out into the blogosphere unless you're prepared for criticism.
Indeed, indeed. Well, the question everybody wants to know, why aren't there more LGBT racial minority role models?
I think that's a good question. I think that has to do with, you know, historical challenges for both LGBT people and people of color in the United States. And when you combine those two, when someone like me is at the intersection of both, you're doubly challenged. And for me, I'm an immigrant too. You throw that on as well.
Right.
So our country historically in our media has had fewer people of color, period. You know, on the news, in television series, in films, that has changed and gotten better over the years. But there's disproportionately less, I think, people of color in our mainstream media than is representative of the U.S. population.
Right.
And you add on top of that, I think, an aversion for many years to having out visible gay people in the media, it makes it even harder to have someone who's both LGBT and a person of color, you know, delivering your news, right, on the television nightly news, hosting a show, being active in politics. There haven't been those role models because of the challenges you have for both. The times are changing, so we definitely have more gay people on television now, which is great. And the point I make is that some people think, wow, we see more gay people on television, you know, Anderson Cooper is out now, you know, and he's all over CNN. We've got characters on television series, such as the couple on Modern Family who are out and visible and gay, at least as fictional characters,
right.
Sometimes as actors as well. But they're predominantly white. And I think some of that has to do with there's a safety in having, you know, white people in media. If you are a casting director, you're a television network executive, you know, you want to appeal to a mass audience, so there's some safety in that.
Yeah.
And in addition, if you're both LGBT and a person of color, I think people, I know I, when I was a kid thinking about working in the media field, I got sort of the message from my parents as well as sort of people around me that it would be a lot harder for me because I was Asian, and I wasn't even out as gay then. So I think, you know, some people don't see that as a possible future for themselves, and they move to other fields.
Well, and you say that in this piece. You write, we need to support their continuing efforts to break through historic ceilings. When they succeed, we need to give them greater visibility. Media outlets can help by more frequently recognizing achievements made by LGBT racial minorities. And you certainly see this, as you said, across the media, that we oh so rarely in the media cover just issues generally of racial minorities and then throw in LGBT, and it's like, well, wait a second. You know, every now and then I guess we'll throw in the unicorn story, but it's certainly not the baseline of U.S. media.
That's correct. And I think before you even get to that, you have to go back to the genesis, as one of the comments on the Huffington Post pointed out, which is, well, are there people who are persons of color and LGBT succeeding and doing things that are noteworthy?
Right.
Right. Because to be role models, to justify being visible, you should do things that are achieving success in your respective fields.
Right.
I think that is true. That is happening. I think it could happen more. I think people of color and who are LGBT have to battle disadvantages in their professional lives. But when they break through those ceilings and achieve success, I think our media could do a better job of spotlighting that more.
Yeah.
Then there's just the pure media and entertainment world, which whether we like it or not, we can consider media and entertainment kind of fluffy, right? There's actors and people who, you know, are on reality shows, for example. And you may not hold those people out to be role models all the time, but whether we like it or not, they are, because they are the face and faces that our young people see on television, on their computer monitors.
Oh, absolutely.
When they open up the magazine and newspaper. That's who people aspire to be.
Oh, yeah.
And if the people who cast our media projects could be a little bit more inclusive in their casting, and if we could see it more likely that you could have an LGBT person of color be a nighttime news anchor on a major network, that would go a long way to helping convey the message that anyone, irrespective of your race or sexual orientation, can achieve success and inspire a whole generation of people behind them to do the same.
Yeah. Now, even the so-called liberal media, let's be a little bit critical right now and see. I don't know if you were kidding when you posted this, so let's find out. Even in the Huffington Post, which has a gay voices section and a black voices section and a Latino voices section, Jimmy, we're looking for the Asian voices section, and it's not there.
I was actually not kidding.
You were not kidding. Just checking.
That.
Okay.
I actually noticed that when knowing that my piece was coming out on the Huffington Post in the Gay Voices. I thought, oh, you know, this is an interesting topic that might have relevance to other populations.
Right.
And I looked, and I knew there was a Black Voices section and a Latino Voices section. I went, oh, there's no Asian Voices section. As I understand it, I don't speak for the Huffington Post and don't claim to.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into what verticals they launch. And
right.
Hopefully they're considering that for the future. But it's just something I noticed. I think, you know, they have rolled out these voices sections gradually over time, so it's not like they're set in stone. So I, and I'm sure many other people, are hopeful one day there will be an Asian voices section, because we Asian Americans want to speak up too.
You have a voice, my friend.
We do, contrary to popular stereotypes about shy Asians. Some of us are happy to speak up and speak out.
Jimmy, when was the last time that someone described you as shy?
1986.
And then what happened?
I'm writing a book about this.
Look at that.
It's about my tips and journey of going from shy to shine. That'll be the name of the book.
Nice.
And for me, it was a lot of things, but mainly it was finding the high school speech and debate world.
Yeah.
I sort of found my home, and I was very shy naturally, but you put me on a stage, you gave me a speech that I would write to talk about, and it's like a light came on.
Look at that. Oh, I miss my high school speech and debate days.
Right, and that was a great environment for me to learn to express and speak out and become more visible. And as a young lawyer, I used to help coach a college speech and debate team with my friend Liesl Reinhardt, who you've had.
Oh, we love her.
Well, we love the Liesl.
Of course.
And one of the great things there was helping people of many different racial backgrounds learn to speak and debate, because the college we coached at is very racially diverse. And so when you get to the topic of opportunities for racial minorities, I think for many of the students we had on that team, it was the first time they felt like they were doing something that they were really good at, that they had the chance to go to a national tournament and come back as a national champion in something, which is the kind of experience that will help them shine in life, rise to levels of achievement that deserve note. And if they happen to be LGBT as well, it would be great to have them, you know, featured in media stories so that people behind them growing up can see, hey, you know what, I'm a Hispanic lesbian young woman, and I see someone just like me who is achieving success, and I want to do the same.
It's all about finding your voice, all about finding your voice. Well, we do have some news to cover for this week's show. Will you do the news with me this week?
Absolutely.
So we are waiting right now, and we were talking before the show about there's a little hesitation to even cover this because it might be outdated by the time this show comes out in a few hours. But we are waiting on pins and needles right now to see what the Supreme Court says about gay marriage. What is your prediction?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot.
I am. Of course I'm putting you on the spot.
My prediction is the Supreme Court will take review of at least one of the DOMA cases to rule on the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act. With regard to the California's Prop 8 case, you know, the case determining whether it was legal to have put on the ballot in California for public vote a ban on same-sex marriage. That one's a little bit more complicated, and I am less certain the Supreme Court will take review of that case, because if the court leaves the decision as is, then gay marriage will return to California without having to rule on any of the interesting legal issues raised by that. So that one I'm a little less certain of. I think it's more likely, in my opinion, the Supreme Court will take review of one of the DOMA cases. Could take both. It's certainly possible to take both, but I think there's less of a chance they'll take the Prop 8 case. That's just my pure opinion. I know a lot of other people out there disagree.
What is your desire to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court?
I have thought about that. When I was a younger lawyer, I thought, well, if I ever left the private practice world where I represent commercial clients and went into the LGBT civil rights world, I used to think, oh, I would love to be the lawyer arguing for gay marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court. That is not going to happen at this point, because someone else will be doing it if the court takes on a case. But there is the advocate in me, as well as the lawyer in me, who would love to have been that person, but I would have had to have gone down that journey many years ago.
You start filing those briefs, and, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, Jimmy. It could be you. It could be you.
I could whip out an amicus brief really quickly.
So we have to talk about California a little bit, because right now what's going on in California, we covered this weeks ago about how there was a ban on the ex-gay therapies. And now it seems in California that a federal judge has ruled this week that new state law banning it might violate the First Amendment rights of three plaintiffs. So there's a temporary order blocking the implementation of the law. How do we feel about this? This seems to be, you know, First Amendment versus really damaging ex-gay therapy.
Well, you know, just to update things, a federal judge in San Francisco yesterday did deny a request to postpone the January 1st, 2013, coming up, start date of that ban,
okay,
the law in California, concluding that the law, you know, quote, I'm reading a quotation from her decision now, prohibits a therapeutic practice deemed unproven and potentially harmful to minors by 10 professional associations of mental health experts. That follows the opposite ruling you were talking about,
right,
where a judge granted an injunction blocking the state of California from enforcing the law, at least as to the three particular plaintiffs. So there's a bit of a split among two judges now on whether or not the law should go into effect on January 1st or not. So I just wanted to give you that update.
We love that update.
First of all, let me say, as a speaker and as someone who is firmly believes in the power of speaking up, I am a huge proponent of the First Amendment,
right,
and of its protections for all of us here in the United States of the ability to speak up and express yourself. With that said, I think it's a novel and somewhat strange argument to say that forming or having, for example, ex-gay therapy performed on, let's say, your child, if you're not allowed to do that, that violates your First Amendment rights. I can see that, you know, some people arguing that, well, you have religious freedom, right, in the United States, and therefore, if this practice is banned, that you are removing someone's religious freedom if their religion dictates that. And I think I'm a big proponent also of protecting religious freedom, but I also think all of those rights have to be balanced upon whether or not your exercise of any rights can harm somebody. And I think because the research and the conclusions of so many mental health associations have consistently now established that ex-gay therapy or conversion therapy is harmful to minors and doesn't succeed, that I think the First Amendment argument, in my opinion, should fail.
Okay. You know, the thing, if we could take a step back for a second, it's sometimes difficult as, you know, as an activist, as an advocate, but I'm not a lawyer. And so when so many of these issues are handled through the court system, which can have such beneficial effects, and we're seeing that all over the place, it feels in some way a little bit inaccessible to me, that I can't really have an effect on these. And I never really anticipated that before, because, you know, I deliberately made the choice, as many do, to not be a lawyer, but I wasn't anticipating that I would feel kind of separated from, oh, I can't really influence these things because you can't really influence the courts. Do you feel more empowered because you understand the law more?
Well, lawyers are always feeling empowered. We like to feel empowered. I definitely do feel a little bit more empowered in terms of being able to understand the legal issues as well as to understand the procedures, because sometimes, you know, people hear about these legal issues that affect the LGBT community, and there's nuances about procedures, right, that affect the strategy in a case and what the ultimate outcome is.
Right.
You know, in the gay marriage cases, people go, well, is the court going to rule for gay marriage or not rule for gay marriage? But
right,
it doesn't always work that way.
Right.
There's, you know, sometimes procedural limitations or strategies that come into play. So I feel empowered in terms of my ability to understand those things, to explain them to people. But I also have to reserve myself, because most people in America don't care about those nuances.
Right.
Right? They just want to know the bigger issue. Will there be same-sex marriage in X state? Will the ban on reparative therapy go into effect or not? So the one thing I actually think is really powerful for lawyers to do is to step back and not think like a lawyer all the time. So I definitely feel empowered to understand it, but then I try to rein that in and say,
yeah,
you know what, I need to explain things in a way the common person can understand.
Makes sense. It makes sense.
Yeah. Speaking of the reparative,
yeah,
therapy, one of the other First Amendment arguments that's made there is that it violates the rights of the mental health professionals who practice the reparative therapy, not just the parents who want to put their children into reparative therapy. And I think that's an interesting argument, because it's sort of saying, if you are a licensed, you know, mental health professional in the state of California, that you have some free expression right to practice a form of therapy, even if your industry says that therapy is ineffective and potentially harmful. And that's where I think the LGBT community has the better side of that argument, in my opinion.
All right, so we got to keep our eyes on that case. We do have to give a quick shout out real quick to Jet Magazine, the wonderful Jet Magazine, which in their December 10th issue, which hit newsstands just today, highlights the wedding of Ravi Perry and Paris Prince. They are the first gay male couple featured in Jet's Jet Love Wedding section. A first.
Yay.
For the Venerable publication. We like that.
Congratulations. We love that.
We love that.
That really, that's a win.
That's a win. That's a win. I need some sort of sound effect that when you say that's a win, then something plays. I don't know what it would be.
Clanging bell.
All right. I'm going to try to insert that in post-production. All right. Well, that wraps things up for this week's show, Jimmy. I'm going to let you do the last piece, which you'll be very good at. Oh, wait. We didn't get an update, though. What's going on with It Gets Better, the musical?
It Gets Better, It Gets Better tour.
Yeah.
Had its premiere in Iowa City.
Lovely.
In October, which I went to, and it was really wonderful and moving. Right now, there's been a little bit of a break as we prepare for a February 1st premiere of the show in Los Angeles at a fundraiser, which I think the Gay Men's Chorus of LA team hopes to be celebrity studded. And then the show goes back on its normal tour. I think the next stop is in Pennsylvania on February 7th, I believe. Well, the cast is there in residence the entire week, but I believe the show is there on February 7th. And, in fact, I'm pulling up for you the actual tour dates. But basically the show is going back on tour in February 7th in University Park, Pennsylvania at Penn State University. And then 2 weeks later, or February 16th, in Lawrence, Kansas. And on February 23rd, it will be in Seattle.
Lovely. And folks can check that out by going to itgetsbettertour.org.
.org, that's right. But if you're in L.A., February 1st, we'd love to see you at the L.A. fundraiser premiere.
I can crash on your couch?
You sure can.
All right. That sounds good to me. Well, folks, we got to get out of here. You guys know what to do. Send me an email. Send it on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Strolling over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our show, including our incredible guest coming up, which features Pulitzer Prize finalist and National Book Award winner Andrew Solomon. He's going to be on the show in a few weeks, and just next week.
Ooh,
we,
impressive.
Very impressive, right? And next week, author Wayne Hoffman, who wrote the book Sweet Like Sugar, which I just finished today and was fantastic. So excited to speak with him. A lot of good things coming up. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in "The Show Is So Gay, Like Us," because we sure as heck like you. I'm giving Jimmy the honor of doing the So Gay piece. He'll know it when it comes. Get out there, folks. Go use your voice in the way that you know how to use it to make a difference in this world. And, of course, remember, why be gay when you can be
so gay?
Ten miles across the city, night, I'll take you. Ride a dusty river of light, I'll take you. Motion, potion, gonna stretch my life, I'll take you. It's a feeling you can't deny,
can't deny,
can't deny.
Already high,
already high,
already sky high.
Ten miles across the suburb night, I'll take you. Some mistake it for a paradise, I'll take you. Retail, detail, try to shrink our size, I'll take you. We ain't fitting in between these lines, and no regret,
no regret.
We ain't done yet,
ain't done yet.
We ain't even begun, run, 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 run.
Could be.
Hey. 10 miles across.
across the country night. I'll take you, we'll let the darkness fill up our eyes. I'll take you, gamble, bramble, and go buck wild. I'll take you, freedom's written in the...